It's 7:33 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Beneduccio in Morgantown. It's been 8 days now since a chemical leaked from a storage tank on the Elk River, contaminating the water supply of 300,000 West Virginians. And this morning, some are still unable to use their water. At the Capitol, lawmakers and state leaders are already investigating the spill and looking into new regulations to prevent others from happening in the future. As Ashton Mara reports, the first piece of legislation to regulate the chemical industry was introduced yesterday in the Senate.
The bill is sponsored by Senate Majority Leader Senator John Unger, who says it would require above-ground holding facilities storing any type of liquid to be inspected just as they are when stored below ground.
So what this legislation will do is close that loophole. It will treat above-ground storage facilities the same as we do underground storage facilities.
Unger says the bill uses pre-existing standards for chemical companies that store liquids underground and the same inspectors who are already employed and examined those underground tanks.
I don't see this as a big burden on the industry itself. I mean, they always say, you know, an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. So if we had such an inspection, registration inspection type program in place for above ground facilities, then this could have been prevented.
But Senator Herb Snyder says he doesn't think proposed legislation will stop there.
Clearly, the one issue that fell through the cracks here was that you had something that could happen above a major metropolitan water intake. That is going to be the heart of what we're looking at. What is near and around these water intakes? Now, we don't want a knee-jerk reaction and start passing legislation next week. We need to understand from the people that have been on the ground, how can we see that this never happens again?
A chemist who specializes in water, Snyder explains little was known about crude MCHM, the chemical that leaked into the water supply, aside from what was on the material safety data sheets that are standard for all chemicals. He says the MSDS sheet for crude MCHM is the same that would be on a can of motor oil. Specifically, he says it will not dissolve in water, but it will flush through the system, as West Virginia American Water officials have said.
If you mixed motor oil into a glass or a pot of water, no, it's not soluble, but it's going to go. Some of it's going to go and mix in just through physical agitation. And you certainly have that in the river where you have a very lightweight oil that it will physically mix. Now, it's not like a teaspoon of sugar or salt that totally dissolves, and it's very, very soluble. But there will be some mixing.
Snyder says crude MCHM has a similar consistency to olive oil. Because of its low solubility rate and the coating effect of oil, it was too much for the carbon-activated filters West Virginia American Water thought would sift out the chemical.
I can't blame them, because activated carbon filters will take out organics. It's that they didn't realize how much there was. The system became quickly overloaded, and in this case, it couldn't take it all out.
Had there been communication between the water and chemical companies, Snyder says the intake system could have shut off and the contamination avoided. But he adds the entire situation could have been much, much worse.
We're very fortunate that this was not something extremely toxic. If this had been benzene or cyanide, or I could just name millions of chemicals that are known toxic, there wouldn't have been enough hospitals in the state to hold everybody.
Snyder says he'll be interested in the findings of Senator Unger's investigation, which will begin today with a hearing including Major General James Hoyer of the National Guard and members of the Department of Environmental Protection response team. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
As the citizens continue to flush their systems of the chemicals spilled into the water supply, questions are beginning to arise. As Aaron Payne reports, the House of Delegates is taking action to answer one of them.
Without clean water to use, businesses around the Kanawha Valley were unable to fully operate for several days, losing needed profits. House Bill 4175 was introduced Wednesday. Within 24 hours, the bill made it through two committees, and delegates voted unanimously to suspend the second and third readings on the House floor to allow immediate action. The bill would allow the governor to determine and then provide relief for small businesses which cannot operate in a declared state of emergency. The relief can range from money from the rainy day fund to tax breaks, depending on what the governor deems appropriate. Delegates from both parties then pleaded that the House approve the bill, including Delegate Doug Scaff.
Think about for a moment going to work one day and saying you're not allowed. Think about going into work, that work paycheck to paycheck, and your business is shut down due to unforeseeable circumstances. This bill right here is a fantastic opportunity for us to work together as a body to help those in need who, based on a particular crisis that was not avoided by water, whether you're in a salon, a barbershop, whether you're a restaurant, imagine going to a dental office without using water. Those people could not work, and those people rely on going to work to make ends meet.
Minority Leader Tim Armstead mirrored Scaff's thoughts.
And I have had people say to me quite specifically that if without assistance, they will not be able to reopen their businesses. And I think that is a very serious concern as we try to get our schools reopened, as we try to get our lives back in order in these nine counties that were affected, as we try to move on and then start to answer some of the serious questions that need to be answered in terms of the long-term issues we need to address on this. We are, quite frankly, in need of immediate help for many of these small businesses in our state, in our area.
The House passed the bill 97-0 with three absent or not voting, making it effective upon passage. Delegate Stephen Skinner said the bipartisan nature was essential in the execution of its passing.
I want to thank everyone who has worked on this bill to flesh it out and get to this point and move with extraordinary speed. This is an example of what we can do when we set things aside and just figure out how to solve a problem.
The bill now moves across the rotunda to the Senate for their approval before taking effect. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Aaron Payne in Charleston.
This is West Virginia Morning at 7:40.
There'll be some strong cold front moving through this afternoon and an Arctic Clipper system by early Sunday. In the meantime, a mix of rain and snow showers likely throughout the day today. There could be an accumulation of an inch of snow or less expected. Highs in the 30s and 40s, cloudy with numerous scattered evening snow showers tonight, and accumulations of 1 to 3 inches are possible. Low temperatures in the teens with wind gusts of up to 35 miles per hour and wind chill values as low as 11 degrees below zero. Boone and Kanawha County schools are closed due to the water crisis this morning.
Mahatma Gandhi is widely recognized as a leader of Indian nationalism in British-ruled India, who employed nonviolent civil disobedience, inspiring movements for civil rights across the world. A professor at West Virginia University's College of Law gave a reading this week in Morgantown from his recently published book that explores a side of Gandhi most are not familiar with, his early years as a lawyer in South Africa. As Glennis Board reports, it's the first extensive examination into this chapter of Gandhi's life.
Practically every Indian in Johannesburg was in the crowd outside the courthouse, awaiting word of Gandhi's fate. When the news of the magistrate's decision arrived, an ocean of small black flags appeared as if on command. Spontaneous chanting broke out. Following a very large single black flag, hoisted aloft on a long pole, the crowd surged out of the square in a procession that would take it onto the street where Gandhi's office was located. Gandhi, meanwhile, was taken to a holding room to await his jailers. As he sat there...
That's author and endowed Woodrow A. Potesta Professor of Law, Charles DeSalvo, reading an excerpt of his new book, The Man Before the Mahatma, M.K. Gandhi, Attorney at Law.
The square where he addressed a large public meeting just a short time ago. Now these were all being taken from him. The thought shook him. For the first time in his life, he was going to prison.
DeSalvo says producing this work that explores Gandhi's early life in South Africa had been a personal goal of his since he discovered that Gandhi was, in fact, a lawyer for 25 years before becoming a pacifist reformer in India.
I was astounded because he becomes a civil disobedient while he's a practicing lawyer. While he's a practicing lawyer, he develops his philosophy and his practice of nonviolent civil disobedience. And I ask myself, is there not a connection between these two, between his practice of law and his development of this philosophy? And why hasn't anybody explored this? So I just decided to make it my mission to do that.
DeSalvo gives much credit to the many law and history students who, along with him, read through some 10,000 newspapers from South Africa, which held keys to unlocking details of Gandhi's career as a lawyer and a politician. DeSalvo says it was that Herculean effort that perhaps prevented anyone else from writing this book earlier. One intriguing insight, DeSalvo says Gandhi had a near-terminal case of shyness, an unlikely quality for an aspiring lawyer. He says Gandhi's severe stage fright made the start of his career, publicly presenting cases, rather rocky.
In fact, in his one of his first cases in India, where he tried to launch a practice and failed, he had to basically withdraw from the case because he was too nervous in court.
DeSalvo explains that it was in South Africa, which at the time was considered something of a backwater, where he worked to overcome his fear.
And he grew in that. He rose to the occasion, and he changed. Before he leaves South Africa, before he gives up the practice of law, he's on his feet giving speeches that last 2 and more hours. This is how much he changed. Wow. He became the Mahatma in South Africa.
Today, DeSalvo says he feels he could go back in time and feel quite comfortable strolling through the streets of Durban and Johannesburg with Gandhi. And he says there were certainly surprises in his journey getting to know the lawyer who became the legend. He points to one example of a tactic that Gandhi, a consummate politician, used to secure the rights of Indians in British South Africa.
The British South Africa, of course, was run by Europeans who identified with the United Kingdom. Because Indians were also members of the empire, Gandhi's argument was, we are fellow members of the empire. You should not be discriminating against us. We are not like these black people.
Wow.
We are better than they are. We are different from them, and you should not treat us like them. It was shocking to see that.
DeSalvo points out that nevertheless, Nelson Mandela would come to lionize Gandhi. He says Mandela recognized that young Gandhi was developing and would someday be a friend to the black community. He hopes that he and all his students take a lesson from the path to Mahatma.
At first, there's a strong distinction between his legal work and the work that is fueled by his politics, his morality, and his spirituality. Eventually, those two come a little closer when he starts devoting some of his practice to civil rights work. And then at the end of his practice, his entire practice is devoted to his political, moral, and spiritual beliefs. And at that point, he becomes integrated. There's only one Gandhi at that point. There's not two. Mm-hmm. There's one. And to me, that is a goal for myself and for all lawyers, that we should have practices that in some respect, none of us can do this the way Gandhi did. In some respect, our practices are an expression of who we are politically, morally, and spiritually.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Glynis Board in Morgantown.
Buddy Miller and Jim Lauderdale perform "The Train That Carried My Gal From Town" on this Mountain Stage Song of the Week.
Fireman's neck.
Buddy Miller and Jim Lauderdale with The Train That Carried My Gal From Town. You can hear this and more music on Mountain Stage, Sunday afternoon at 2 on West Virginia Public Radio. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for West Virginia Public Broadcasting's news bureaus comes from Shepherd University, West Virginia University, Marshall University, and Concord University. Our news director is Beth Voorhees. Our director is Bob Powell. West Virginia Morning is produced with the assistance of Cecilia Mason, Suzanne Higgins, Clark Davis, Jessica Lilly, Glynis Board, Dave Mistich, and Ashton Mara. From Morgantown, I'm Beneduccio. Good morning.